I believe we're joined by Tiffan Dixon. She is a former lawyer and is now an instructor at the Political Science Division of the Hatfield School of Government, Portland State University. Are you there, Tiffan?
Yes. Hello, Phil.
Hello, and hey, thanks very much for joining us. I want to ask, I guess I want to ask about a couple of things here. We were just speaking to Portia Carrigaya, daughter of the Colonel Patrick Carrigaya, who was assassinated, and was there's been a feature article in the Globe and Mail. You probably remember our Canada's national newspaper.
Yeah.
And saying that there is actually a government-inspired assassination program coming from Kigali, and that a number of people have died and others are under threat, and they produce quite a bit of evidence. They also kind of go into the history of the present leader of Rwanda. And since you've seen it, I'd just like to ask you, what are your reflections after reading the article?
Well, I mean, my first response is to be happy that this is covered, and it's covered meticulously. This comes on the heels of other work done by Howard French as well in Newsweek, if memory serves. So, you know, there's a positive sense that there's the actions of Kagame are being scrutinized, and he's no longer an untouchable figure, nor is the regime untouchable. But this is also accompanied by a sense of sadness, a sense of déjà vu. You know, back in 1998, we know that the former Prime Minister Seth Sendashonga was killed in broad daylight in the streets of Nairobi. And you know, we have a pretty good inference to the best explanation that murder was committed by the RPF,
mm-hmm.
Was sponsored by Kagame. If only that he had been a victim of an assassination attempt previously, and a man had been caught attempting to throw away a smoking pistol into a smoking gun.
Yes.
Yeah, into a gas station toilet, and it turns out that that young man was an employee at the Rwandan embassy in Nairobi. So I mean, this is constant, and it's been, you know, happening pretty much from the start of Kagame's taking power in Rwanda, and there's a pattern. The targets are generally people who are speaking out against Kagame's policies, and they're not speaking out against any sort of positive policy. They're speaking out against, in the case of Sendashonga, it was the detention policy of genocide suspects in the jails, and he was promoting some type of triage in order not to to simply imprison everyone, which is which was the case early on. I mean, practically, you know, one-fifth of adult Hutu males were incarcerated. So that has been a pattern. Dissent is not brooked, and nor does Kagame seem to accept any sort of opposition, and I mean, including imprisoning domestic opposition in Rwanda. But those closest to him, those who know the most, are in the greatest danger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, further on that, you as a counsel raised issues which are raised in the Globe and Mail's article, I wonder what you're thinking there. I know that you were one of the counsel who stood up and said, we need to know what the prosecution and investigators of the United Nations know about the assassination of the two presidents, African presidents, the president of Rwanda, president of Burundi. And you didn't get any takers on that question. And the Globe and Mail touches on that. They said, because Mr. Carrigaya and General Nyamwasa apparently had been speaking to various international inquiries into that shooting down, and indicating that Paul Kagame was culpable. So you want to talk about what was your experience with that, and why didn't the UN take it up?
Well, I mean, there's a long history there, too. I made a request for disclosure of the results of any investigation the prosecution carried out into the shooting down of the plane back in February 1997, so none of us are getting any younger. And the response from the prosecutor that day was to say, you know, we're not in the business of investigating plane crashes. So, I mean, already their response was loaded.
Yes.
To the point of not even acknowledging that this plane was shot down by SAM-16 missiles, and that happened to be, you know, my first day in that court, and I realized we're in big trouble here, because it was pretty clear to me that was universally acknowledged. I mean, who shot down the plane was still in question, but that it was a shoot down, that those presidents and the chief of staff of the Rwandan armed forces and others were assassinated. I didn't realize that was a question, and yet, even in the verdict finding my client guilty, that judgment refers to a plane crash.
Hmm.
So, I mean, no, there were no takers, and we've learned since that there had been an investigation, and I know that you've covered this meticulously. There had been an investigation at the prosecutor's office. This was a prosecutor, the late Horrigan, who submitted results or preliminary results of an investigation to then prosecutor Louise Arbour. But I guess the evidence that they were finding pointed in the direction of Kagame, pointed in the direction of what they referred to as a network. And Arbour, despite having told Horrigan initially that she was very excited about the direction in which the investigation was going, promptly asked Horrigan to bring his documentation to The Hague so that they could meet in person. And when they did meet in person, she promptly asked for that documentation and told him the investigation was shut down.
She was less excited.
Well, she was evidently less excited. So,
yeah.
Who knows what transpired in the meantime?
Yeah.
Now, you know, some may say, and some have said, you know, there's a political importance attached to the shooting down of the presidential plane, and yes, it is the proximate cause of massacres, of resumption of civil war, of you know, of the genocide. But of what relevance would it be for your client? You know, why would you, defense lawyer, be entitled to receive discovery of investigations into the shooting down of the plane? And so my response is, well, to look at the indictment. And the indictment accused my client of George Rutaganda, by the way, not just the client, and the late George Rutaganda, was accused of distributing weapons in the afternoon of April 6th, 1994. That would be before the plane was shot down. And so the inference there is that it would be Rwandan government forces that shot down the plane. And so therefore, I mean, it's relevant.
Of course.
I was certainly entitled to ask for it. But results of that investigation, I suppose, we'll have to wait for them as the Spanish and French investigations continue.
Isn't that an amazing situation? The French investigation that seems to go on for decades, and all these matters. There's such a powerful political climate that surrounds all these discussions. Because these governments have narratives that they're trying to cling to. I want to make sure I ask you about this. Carla Del Ponte has written her account of working at the tribunal, and she now says that if you do not charge anyone from the RPF with the crimes, which she said we know they were involved in, if no one is charged, then she says it's victor's justice, and it isn't, and therefore it is not justice. You've probably seen those remarks. Have you got some comment on that?
Well, I mean, she's absolutely right. I mean, I would think that even if two or three, you know, low ranking RPF officials were charged and accused, it would still be Victor's justice. And mm-hmm. I think this is a way for Ms. Del Ponte to contrast the ICTR with the ICTY, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, that was a little bit more democratic, if you will, in arresting individuals from other former republics of former Yugoslavia. But it doesn't mean that the sentencing was consistent or fair there. That being said, I mean, whether or not to use the term Victor's justice, I think it's a done deal. I think it's not going to happen. There will not be RPF charges against the RPF simply because we're out of time and we're out of budget.
Yes.
So, you know, speaking of things that take decades to happen, I believe it was in 2004 that the Security Council of the United Nations asked the ICTR to begin its completion strategy.
So it only took 10 years.
Well, and we're not quite there yet.
And not quite there yet.
So it's not going to happen, and that is pretty scandalous. And this was, I mean, back in the day, in the heady days of the 90s, the holiday from history, the buzzword was, we're establishing these ad hoc institutions, we're intervening in the name of the struggle against impunity.
Mm-hmm.
But what we see here, in particular with the ICTR, this is absolutely impunity at the highest levels. The RPF, and they knew already in 1994 with the preliminary results of the Gersony investigation. They knew with the report of Denis Segui, RPF committed crimes within the jurisdiction of the ICTR.
Mm-hmm.
We've known that for 20 years.
Yeah, and here we find ourselves, you know, with the Weekend Globe saying that the person who has been blocking any charges against the RPF is himself running some sort of Murder Incorporated, which is the consequence of having impunity, I gather.
Well, and friends in high places, because I doubt that he can do that alone.
I think, yeah.
Most African leaders don't have that power over international.
I'm sure that the others look on in envy.
Yeah, indeed.
It introduced me to Clinton and Blair. we're speaking to Tiffany Dixon, and she is an instructor at the Political Science Division at Hatfield School of Government, Portland State University. And before we leave the Rwanda subject, I want to mention something to you, and certainly struck me, that a very well-known British journalist named, I can't say his first name, but Doyle, did a special feature for the BBC about an incident made famous by the movie The Hotel Rwanda, in which people in the hotel are going to be taken from the government side in Rwanda over to the rebel or RPF side, and they are going to be conveyed by UN forces. And this, of course, did occur, and the drama was that they reached a roadblock where the people were concerned and alarmed that prominent individuals, many of whom now are in the current government of the RPF, were going to be going through their lines when, on their side, there were no Hutus being or government supporters being transferred the other direction. At any rate, there was quite a hullabaloo, and it almost came to a shootout. Now, Doyle is making a story in which he says he's found a true hero. And this would be, of course, the deceased Captain Mbaye from Senegal. And he's interviewed people, and they're all deciding there has to be a biography of the captain, and there has to be a movie, of course. I think Mr. Doyle might want to put himself in that movie. Now, Your client, George Rutaganda, is not mentioned, but he was there, wasn't he?
Yes, very much.
Could you tell us what happened from your memory?
Yeah, well, first...
By the way, there's no disputing he was there.
No disputing, since it is conceded by the prosecutor, and what's also conceded by the prosecutor at trial was that, in fact, it was Mr. Rutaganda, his intervention that permitted the situation to de-escalate, and for that UN convoy to proceed to RPF lines. George Rutaganda was actually not initially present there, which would suggest that he's somehow at the roadblock. In fact,
yes.
he was at home, kicking back as much as possible in the circumstances, and a UN officer, Amadou Demé, who knew him previously, because Mr. Rutaganda was known in Kigali not for being some maniac, but rather for being a purveyor of Danish beer, and that's why, of course, the UN all knew him. Where you have to know who's got the liquor. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Demé begged George Rutaganda to go to Sopeka and see what he could do, and George didn't really think that he had any.
He
kind
put
of
his
power
life at risk in that situation. I mean, that was a very dangerous situation Mr. Demé drew him into.
Absolutely. And
we should mention too, probably in fairness, the préfet, I believe, was present. And he was not successful. He did his best, but...
He's préfet of Kigali, and that's like super mayor, but he's also a colonel in the Rwandan army. I mean, so if he didn't manage to persuade these angry civilians to let them through, it's sort of hard to believe that anyone would assume that George could do that. But it just so happens that George is a kind, amiable... pleasant guy who, mm-hmm. and I repeat, has beer, mm-hmm. Has cases of beer, and who was able to negotiate some kind of trade with these people.
Mm-hmm. Now, that was, I myself believe that we have to, stay on the case of Mr. Doyle and others who want to turn this into a story of a UN officer who deserves all the credit in the world for he too was at risk. Everyone there that day at Sopeka was at risk. Yep. The people in the convoy, the UN soldiers, and by the way, the people at the roadblock who are always pictured as quite evil, but in fact, they didn't attack. It was all talked through. I've read an account by a Ghanaian officer who said, "We bungled it. On our side, UN bungled that."
Mm-hmm.
They tried to force an issue instead of talking the matter through prior to the whole business. But if they're going to portray the captain as a hero, then Mr. Rutaganda deserved to be standing alongside him in the same picture.
Yeah, well, at least it's better than the portrayal in the film Hotel Rwanda, where the stand-in for General Dallaire goes guns blazing.
Yes, solves the whole problem by waving a pistol.
Yes, when in fact we know that there was not a white person to be seen, mm-hmm. at that time.
No, now it's very important, and I really appreciate you sharing that with us. And I wish, by the way, that the transcripts were studied by people who think they know what happened, because, as you say, even the prosecution did not argue that point. And Rutaganda suffered a great deal and needed to be respected for the effort he made when requested by the United Nations. Now, of course, I've told people in the introduction, it's very important for us to get your views. You have not only practiced international law, but you also teach courses which take up such issues as the one we're witnessing today in Ukraine. There's been a lot of violence, and it's a kind of nightmare where people are not sure whether we're going to have a strange love ending here. I want to ask you, right off the top, the present government in Kyiv is saying that it's going to establish order in the eastern part of the country, and they're being egged on and encouraged by President Obama. The people of the East, spokespersons for the demonstrators and for those occupying buildings, have said Kyiv is not a legitimate government. I want to know your opinion. What happened on February 21, 22? Did they have a legal transfer of power at that time?
Well, the first thing in that timeline, and it's a crazy short timeline as we know, is that the requests that were made by the opposition to revert to the previous constitution was accepted, and it was voted in by parliament. So we have that constitution, and it's the one they wanted. I want to emphasize that.
Mm-hmm.
That constitution has a whole chapter relating to the presidency, and there are only and by the way, if you go to the website of the acting president of Ukraine, you'll notice that those provisions lead to a page not found 404 error. I checked just before the show. I thought you might enjoy that.
Yes.
But there are only four ways a president can cease to exercise his or her power, and that's by resignation, health, impeachment, or death.
Mm-hmm.
And resignation, because that I think that's what's being argued by the U.S. State Department. Dereliction of duty, he fled, and therefore he's no longer the president.
Mm-hmm.
But the Constitution, and again, the Constitution that these Maidan people wanted so badly, sets out procedure for announcing a resignation. It has to be announced personally by the president at a session of the Rada,
mm-hmm.
Which didn't happen. And Yanukovych said, "I didn't resign." I mean, if we look at reasons of health, ill health, but that also has to be confirmed by the Rada, and it has to be based on an independent medical opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise. And this is what they ended up doing at the Rada. They claim to have voted the impeachment of Yanukovych.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll read this in every account. Three-quarter majority as provided for in the Constitution. But that's not what the Constitution sets out. It would be much too easy to impeach anyone if it only required a vote.
By the way, just in terms of journalism, there's a... The word impeachment is not understood, even in the U.S. where they've had a couple of them.
Right.
People think that impeachment is removal. It's actually a process to test the charges, right?
It's a process to test the charges, and in this instance, I mean, according to the Ukrainian constitution, the first step is the allegation of treason or other crimes. Allegedly committed by the president, and then the appointment of a special prosecutor, a team of special investigators that will return yes or no with the results of their investigation was treason or another crime committed. After that, it has to go for review to the Constitutional Court of Ukraine, where what's examined are is the respect of due process and the reliability of the evidence submitted by the special prosecutor. Mm-hmm. Only then does it go back to Rada to mm-hmm. be voted.
Mm-hmm. Now, well,
so that didn't happen.
Certainly not.
So you ask me, is it a legitimate government? Well, I can tell you that the acting president is not acting as president in any way that's consistent with the Constitution. So that's lawyerly talk for no, it's not a legitimate, at least it's not, it's unconstitutional.
He's merely acting.
Yeah, according to the provisions of the Constitution that the Maidan folks fought for and obtained.
Now, and then following on that, we have a situation where they say they make all these announcements, and then they say, within days, our prime minister is going to go to Washington, he's going to go to Belgium, to Brussels, and he's going to start signing agreements. He's going to make a deal which will borrow money from the IMF, which says it's going to impose certain, as they do, austerity practices. Where did they get the authority to do any such thing?
Well, they took it.
It is a coup. It's just basically.
Well, it's a coup with a patina of pseudo legality, mm-hmm. and it makes it because the media coverage is so sloppy, it suffices for these new unelected authority to simply state that they had an impeachment vote.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that there was an actual impeachment investigation. So, I mean, and the question there is, what was the hurry?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
it would have really helped that new regime gain some legitimacy across the whole country. Have an investigation. If they come up with some serious crimes, most people will be thrilled to see him be removed. And then mm-hmm. the constitutional procedure for appointing the new prime minister, who is the chairperson of the parliament, can then be followed.
Yes, and if you intend to introduce austerity, maybe give the people a little chance to think about that first.
Well, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. No, everything has conspired to the disaster that we're now seeing unfolding.
Mm-hmm. This is Tufan Dixon of Portland State University, and I want to ask about this. Nomenclature. The New York Times and others have agreed to say that anything done in the East is now called pro-Moscow or pro-Russia. But I hear another word which was not permitted in our English discourse, which is federalization. Could you talk about that?
Well, yes. I mean, the individuals who are occupying buildings in the eastern and southern part of Ukraine are interested. I mean, and I would call them, I don't know, pro referendum, mm-hmm. because they would like to be consulted on a different organization, and that would require constitutional change of Ukraine, mm-hmm. a kind of federal state that would recognize their language. They're primarily Russophone, and different, cultural heritage and even a different sense of a memory, local national identity. So it's kind of interesting to see federal states, mm-hmm. like Canada or the United States, wag the finger, and sermon these people for merely wanting to be consulted as to whether or not they could live in a federal as opposed to a unitary state.
Mm-hmm. It is striking. I've read several very persuasive articles saying by people who studied this, saying clearly, almost along the Dnieper River, you have different communities, and federalism is the way you solve that, as opposed to diktat from a capital. Particularly when it's coming, by the way, from people who seem to be highly motivated and suffer from their own nationalism, which causes them to have an extremely hostile attitude towards other people that they claim have to listen to them.
Well, yes, and I think we have to be clear and say that it's more than in the West. It's more than mere nationalism. It's nationalism that's fed by an admiration for, Nazi collaborationist figures like Stefan Bandera. It's neo-Nazis. That sentiment exists mm-hmm. in the West. Mm-hmm. And there are four members of this party, Svoboda, that are in this illegitimate, constitutionally mm-hmm. challenged new government, and the memory of communities in the East with respect to the Second World War and the massacres that took place have been reawakened by these recent events, mm-hmm. and to see not just nationalists but folks who don't mind parading with SS insignia, that may not. That's just not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
I just really want to insist on saying that it's more than nationalism, and also to critique what we keep hearing, because there's guidance in how to think about this that's kindly provided by the U.S. State Department with alarming regularity. So they have, you know, these lists, 10 things that Russia is lying about, and consistently, the State Department claims that there are no ultra-nationalist elements in the acting government, and that's simply false. Svoboda just
and very troubling, because they seem to be actually quite proud of themselves, and then they're easy to find.
Well, and so it's absolute gaslighting to be stating that it isn't the case. Svoboda, mere 2 years ago, was called the Nationalist Socialist Party, and there was, I believe, last year, a declaration made by the European Parliament that this was an extremist, xenophobic, and anti-Semitic party, and that that they should not be a part of any coalition in the Ukrainian government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and on top of that, we had Mr. McCain and a liberal senator from Connecticut, I believe, standing alongside the leader of Svoboda, and I want to get your thoughts about that. There they were in Kiev, making all kinds of promises and actually inciting by talking about being with the West as opposed to the backward East, etc. And now today, they are speaking about Russian phantoms in the East, but McCain was not a phantom. He's the real deal, and he was in Kiev inciting people. And then we had a secret visit by the head of the CIA to Kiev, yep. Where at first the Americans claimed he wasn't there. Then they said, yes, he was there. And then they said he was under an assumed name.
Yes.
I mean, that's a pretty scary situation.
Yes, it is. It is a scary situation. And, you know, let's not forget also the Undersecretary of State, Victoria Nuland, who we heard in a phone conversation, give her best estimate to the American ambassador of who should be in power. It turns out that's who's in power.
she apparently knew who was going to win the Kentucky Derby. She's ahead of these things.
Yes, and so, you know, what was reported with respect to that conversation was her unpleasant use of colloquial English, but when in fact
with no cost, by the way. She said it was her, she acknowledges, and everybody sails along like, well, that's the way our personnel operate.
Oh yeah, it's proof that machismo is no longer the exclusive preserve of males.
Yeah.
Because it works. That's how that State Department wants to be seen.
Crazed males with four stars on their shoulders. This is Stephen Dixon. I want to make sure I know that you've commented on this. There's an author, a woman named Slaughter.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who names these people, but Ms. Slaughter
has
an idea how to solve this. Could you talk about that?
It almost pains me. This is one of those where to begin.
Breedlove and Slaughter.
Yeah. Well, so Anne-Marie Slaughter was the former director of policy planning at the State Department. You know, associated with, I guess, the Democratic hawks, not to be confused with Power. See, Power and Slaughter, who's UN ambassador.
Yeah.
UN ambassador, United States ambassador to the UN. Sorry, and she taught at Harvard for a very long time. Again, very influential political scientist, and She's got an idea that, I mean, unless you're looking at it from the standpoint of it's just so crazy it might work, she's advocating in a recent op-ed that what has to be done now is Obama has to strike Syria.
Solve the Ukraine problem
It's going to put Putin in his place.
I see.
And though we can't do that legally,
mm-hmm.
We can just do it and have the UN rubber stamp it afterwards. and that's going to improve everyone's attitude.
By the way, does she go that far that it would be sort of you could get applause after that stunt?
Yes.
Amazing.
Yes. She states that it's and I quote, "time to change Putin's calculations, and Syria is the place to do it."
So a twofer.
It just strikes me as
you kill Assad and scare Putin. It's
the most imprudent thing imaginable, and I think you know that currently Vladimir Putin is being punished for having Putin and his foreign minister Lavrov for having brokered agreements that brought everyone back from the brink.
Yes.
With respect to Iran, with respect to Syria, yeah. You know, if Obama says chemical weapons are the red line, all right, let's peel back behind that red line. But you'll still have these liberal democratic hawks furious that agreement was brokered by the Russians.
Yes, it seems like I think you're right on a point here that Putin three or four times in the past 12 months has said something very sensible and helpful, which I think the world has noticed, but it seems to infuriate the Washington, New York crowd.
Well, it's really unfortunate because it didn't have to be the case, but over the past couple decades, and the Russian Federation has taken on all sorts of projects and with the United States. So, in other words, cooperation. There's cooperation with respect to Afghanistan, counterterrorism, counter narcotics operations. Not to mention the International Space Station. So, you know, when the State Department says we're no longer going to cooperate with the International Space Station, I mean, you say that when there are astronauts up in space with Russians.
We've reached our Dr. Strangelove moment.
I really do hope that we're not quite there yet.
Yeah. But, in terms of characterization, I think you would agree that film is a good place to start to understand, eh?
Absolutely, absolutely, and that's why I showed it to my students.
Well, very good. We have to go. Tiffin Dixon, thank you very, very much. It's been very helpful. I hope we talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Phil.
Okay, bye-bye. So, Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM. We'll see you next week.